of shit. Shit and bullshit. Oh, Jeremy, it's full of shit.
Oh, Jeremy!
Oh, Jeremy!
Oh, Jeremy!
Oh, Jeremy! Oh, Jeremy, it's full of shit. He's full of shit. Shit and bullshit. Oh, Jeremy, it's full of shit.
Hello, dear listener. That dream that you thought that you were going to wake up from after that Thursday in November, where you thought that Donald Trump was going to become the President of the United States, but it was all a dream. You thought you were going to wake up and it was all going to be fine. Well, that happened this week. And I'm very sorry to be the bearer of that bad news if you've managed to avoid that piece of information coming across your desk. Probably, objectively, the most important thing to have happened over the last week. But we're not going to talk about that at all this week.
I like that you started the podcast by talking about the thing that you said you wanted to talk less about in the podcast. So yes. That's consistent. That's nice.
Let's pull them in. And then disappoint them with the topics we've actually chosen. Hello, my name is Jazza, by the way. If this is your first time listening, welcome to the Right Dishonorable Podcast. We talk about politics, social issues, and current events weekly. And we feed them into your ears in a podcast form. I am joined, as ever, by the incomparable Jimmy Nichols.
Hello.
That's you.
That's a good adjective. I like that you're working away through them bit by bit. But
I'm sure you have a thesaurus.
Do you know how to read it though, or use it?
I mean, I feel like you're being really ableist because I am dyslexic.
That was what I was referencing. I like to get my abuse in early.
Yeah, I mean that's just really quite nasty. there was no need. So Jimmy, what are we actually going to talk about this week in the world of the world?
The world of the world. Well, there was...
I've used up all of my vocabulary early on.
Seemingly so. there was this this march yesterday in London and Washington and New York and many other cities.
Most of the big cities.
In the West, right. Jazza, you know, don't be so occidentally focused, you know. Broaden your horizons.
But we are, if nothing else, occidentally focused, apart from whenever you allow me to go off on one about China.
Which is quite frequently, to be fair. But you actually you attended this march in London.
Jimmy doesn't believe in civic action.
Not when it involves standing outside in the cold. I'm not down with that. I mean, I actually am sceptical generally about some of the civic actions, as Jazza put it, but yeah, it was also really cold, so I didn't go.
Poor baby, and don't even pretend, you had no intention of coming anyway.
No, I had no intention of coming. I didn't even...
We will find out why later, because actually I don't know. I'm curious to see what your justification is.
I don't feel I have to justify not turning up to an event. But I will do for you. Aside from the Women's March, what else are we talking about? Because I have forgotten, despite us discussing it just before I press record. This happens every single week.
Stop destroying the illusion of us actually being prepared for these podcasts, Jimmy. How many times do I have to tell you?
We do prepare, and then as soon as we hit record, it all goes out the window. It's kind of like fighting a war, basically.
Speak for yourself. I am thoroughly prepared and ready to roll off the rest of our topics. We're going to talk about, we now know, thankfully, that Brexit means Brexit means Brexit means Brexit. So that's brilliant. Theresa May, the leader of the United Kingdom, Great Britain and Northern Ireland, delivered a speech at the Davos... what is that called?
The Davos World Economic Forum.
Ah, yeah, the Davos Forum.
I mean, Davos is actually the name of the place where it's located, but I don't think it's in the title of the event. Indeed, it's the city that gives, or town that gives its name to Davos Man, who I assume we will be discussing at some point.
I don't know what Davos Man is. I'm fascinated to find out. That would be brilliant.
Davos Man is similar to Essex Man, but he has a lot more money.
Ah. Oh, okay. I didn't realise that there was a similar stereotype that I was battling with on mainland Europe. That's nice to know.
I don't think it applies to you, but yeah. Go on.
I mean, you don't define me, Jimmy, have you?
I'm just using words how they're used by other people, all right? I'm not trying to force this down your throat. Anyway.
But Theresa May set out her plans for Brexit. She's confirmed quite firmly that her goal is for the United Kingdom to completely leave the customs union and to leave the EU altogether. There have been debates and pushes for what many people call the 48%, those who wanted to stay, who voted in the referendum last year to stay in the European Union, for a softer Brexit that would allow for there to still be a customs union, for there still to be economic ties with some of the regulations that exist within the European Union. Theresa May has confirmed that she has no intention of doing that, and she wants to create a completely new situation, set up a new trade deal between the United Kingdom, newly separate from the European Union, with our mainland partners. She touched on the land border with Ireland. She's been asked quite a lot about turning the UK into a tax haven. It's all bubbly, very light stuff, very fun.
Yeah, it does sound it. I didn't drift off then while you were listing all the things that happened. What are we...
Dickhead!
Sorry. What's the third topic? Because we are going to talk. I imagine that's going to take us quite a long time to wade through all of that.
Have you genuinely forgotten what we said our third topic was going to be? I can't believe you, Jimmy. You're terrible.
I am pretty terrible. Let me just...
We're going to talk about... So last year... the Parliament of Westminster of the UK decided to renew Trident, which is our nuclear deterrent, which ended up being shipped around in giant submarines under the water. And there was a test just before said vote, and the missile that was unarmed, that was fired, malfunctioned, and they lost control of that missile.
It went the wrong way, didn't it?
Yeah, it went completely the wrong way. It was meant to go left and went right, or whatever.
That's quite a basic thing to go wrong, you'd have thought.
It is quite a basic thing to go wrong. And I'm curious to see what we think about whether or not this would have affected the vote and the debate around the UK maintaining a nuclear arsenal. Well, so there.
Maybe we have a nuclear arsenal, but we in fact lack any sort of means to fire it in a specific direction.
Yeah, we've just got some things that go bang and no way of making the thing that go bang move anywhere properly. So great, excellent.
That seems safe.
Yeah, completely safe. Although it is constantly under the water. Really.
Yeah, that's great. So circling back from nuclear explosions to women's marches, which have absolutely no connection to each other whatsoever.
Are you being facetious there? I don't even know. Are you being stealthily misogynistic?
I don't think so.
Comparing women's activism to nuclear deterrence.
I don't even know. I was just aware that we'd listed all the topics and then we have to go back to the first one.
Very good.
Yeah, that's
how this
works.
This is a very meta podcast already.
I'm afraid it's. We're recording this at 8:30 on a Sunday evening, and apparently we are already both too tired and the week hasn't even started to sensibly talk about anything.
Don't tell the listener this. They don't need to know. So I went on a march over the weekend with some female friends and lots of other female people, but it was an inclusive march, so there were people of all genders.
We usually do refer to them as women or girls, I suppose, Jazza.
You don't have to
refer to them as female people.
Female people. I want to know, so I had my reasons for going. Jimmy, I want to know what your perception from kind of the outside, because this got, these were actually relatively big marches across Europe and across the United States.
Do you know how many people turned up in London?
we haven't got like final figures. I think it was between 100,000 and 200,000 was so what the so organizers said, but we haven't had that confirmed by the police yet.
So usually organizers overestimate the number of people in a march. But yeah, that's still quite a lot of people. In relation to your first question,
you so unimpressed.
Well, I suppose that does vaguely link to what I'm about to say, in that I think marches are largely pointless. I don't think they really achieve a great deal. They certainly don't achieve a great deal on their own. I guess you can plausibly argue that the cumulative effect of them does contribute somewhat, but it's fairly difficult to measure their effectiveness in any significant way. I think they probably mostly serve as a means for the people on the march to feel better about whatever it is they're protesting against, which I guess is a function in and of itself. I mean, do you disagree with anything I've just said?
No, I don't disagree at all, and I feel quite strange about like going on marches and going on protests and those kinds of things, because I unfortunately we live in a world where actually I think they rarely have a huge amount of impact that is really measurable. Like for me anyway, the first time I was ever really aware of political activism in the form of marches was with the Million Man March against the Iraq War. Uh-huh. In the UK in the early 2000s. It would have been 2001 or two? 2002.
Two or three, I'd have thought.
Yeah. And that did bloody nothing, did it? We went to war. We were ignored.
So did you go on that march then?
No, my parents wouldn't have taken me to that, and I don't think I wasn't anywhere near. I was like 10 or 11 years old. So I was nowhere near. I wasn't really aware of what was happening, and I don't have the kind of parents that would have taken me on a march. They're not those kinds of people. But historically, I just see that as an overhanging example of how readily politicians will ignore the will of the people. And then
in the case of the Iraq march, even though it was actually more than 1 million people, I think, turned up to the Iraq march, especially if you count other places where I think it was happening simultaneously, but more people in Britain decided not to go on a march that day against the Iraq war than went on the march.
You love using that kind of argument, don't you?
You mean factually correct logic? I do.
No, but still a million people to decide to come to London from all over the UK and take a day out of their time to say we don't want this to happen. Like, what did you expect? All like 60 something million people in the UK to say, yeah, I'm protesting now. Like,
I think it's disingenuous to say that the British people were overlooked purely on the basis of the march. I mean, I think if you look back at polling around that time, there was a majority of British people who were against the march, but you could have ascertained that without the march needing to... Sorry, against the Iraq war.
So I think that you're right in what you were saying earlier, in that I think marches are primarily for the people who are taking part in them. Another example that is really salient for me was the refugee, like, we welcome refugee march that we attended in London. I believe it would have been last year, because of the small amount of Syrian refugees that the UK had decided to take, like capping it at like 20,000 when Germany was taking 1 million. And that did nothing to change government policy.
In terms of tangible effects, it's very difficult to... I mean, there are like examples of marches such as the... Or not a march so much, but the poll tax riots, which started off with a protest march. You can say that they added to the momentum against the poll tax, but then also there were various things going on in Margaret Thatcher's cabinet at the time. So I think if they're part of a wider movement, then they have a significance, but I'm not sure that, especially the peaceful ones, the ones that don't end up with people smashing things, I think are particularly ineffective, which is sad, but you know, that's kind of a reality, I think.
But the thing is, where those two particular marches that are very that stand out for me are very different to the women's march that I attended over the weekend, because the anti-war march in 2002-2003 and the refugee march last year, they were both very specifically for a cause. They were very specifically, we want to change a thing, whether that be the UK not going to war or the UK accepting more refugees from the Syrian conflict. Whereas this march, I think more than any that I've ever been to, was meant to be for the people who were taking part, because it can it's quite depressing that a man who has such abhorrent views and has acted horrifically towards women in the past has managed to get elected, has nonetheless managed to get elected to the most powerful position in the world. And I think that frustration is what was kind of being remedied here by this collection of people coming together and taking part in something communally, and that's what it was for.
So it was kind of a general malaise and down with this sort of thing.
It was more of a, let's remind ourselves that there are decent people in the world who have the same views as us. That's how it felt. And it felt like obviously none of these marches existed in order to take down the President of the United States, who's now actually Donald Trump.
Isn't it a bit weird that people are protesting the, you know, however you feel about the election, the legitimate election of a foreign president? Is that not strange?
I don't think so. Because we I think that you would equally but like people protest human rights abuses from other countries outside embassies in London all the time. This happens with like Russia, Azerbaijan, like a couple of protests that I have been to that have occurred in within the UK, but are about the attitudes and actions of foreign governments. I don't think that that's particularly strange, but I think that the point of it was the solidarity thing, and I think there was something quite euphoric, probably isn't the right word, not as strong as euphoric, like satisfying, about scrolling through Twitter and Instagram afterwards and seeing all of the different cities everywhere doing the same thing and saying, like, this is a bit shit, isn't it?
Is it not a bit strange after the year that we had last year to be celebrating the fact that people have the same views as you? Is that not an odd thing to do, like, given how divisive, like, both the American election and the European referendum were?
Oh yeah, it's because they lost. Like, for the first time in a very long time, the liberal agenda has lost.
I appreciate that that they lost on both of those counts, but
yeah, and they need to feel better about it.
Like, yeah, but I'm saying that part of the reason they lost is that they're so disconnected from the other side. And if anything, now should be the time for some. Well, you'd have thought that now should be the time for some sort of reconciliation and actually making more of an effort to understand other people's points of view.
Yeah, I am not. I think that you're right there. Do you know who Tommy Lahren is?
No.
She's like a shock jock on like American cable news. Who loves Trump and our troops. God bless America. And she said in her show, I believe last night, that no matter how march if you want to, but nothing is going to change anything if you refuse to engage with the man at the top and you refuse to engage with the two Republican-led with the Republican-led House and the Republican-led Senate. And she's right. Frankly, there is going to need to be engagement with the powers that be, at least for the next 2 years, for as long as those legislatures are going to be Republican, and for as long as Trump is going to be president, however long that is. Like, right. Otherwise, everything just stops, you know? Like, people... like, stuff like abortion rights and stuff like equal opportunities and people, stuff like healthcare and stuff like foreign policy isn't going to stop. And so if you want to have any kind of a sway in it, you need to engage, which is why I always find... which is why I always still remain skeptical and wary of the effectiveness of protest, because it is actively unengaging very often with... the idea of working with people in power and compromise. And so I think that you cannot, if you want to change shit, then you cannot have one in the form of protest without the other, which is working with the people that you hate. I agree with you.
Right, okay. So you're on balance saying that protests are ineffective but good for the people that are in them, but they're... I mean, do they make it more or less likely that those people would work, or not necessarily the protests in and of themselves, but the attitudes that would lead somebody to protest? Do they make it more or less likely that they would work with the other side?
I think that very often protests end up, and any kind of civic action, end up catapulting people into more direct action, whether that be in local government or whether that be with their own representatives and holding them to account and attending MP surgeries and those kind of things. I think that I have no evidence of this. This is purely how I perceive it. But I think that people become more willing to then engage with politics further because being around people who see something that they disagree with and realizing that there are a large number of people who agree with you can be incredibly powerful, especially if they're the people that went to the march over the weekends and who attended from far away places where perhaps they have views that are against Trump but are the minority views in their own community. So people who in the USA traveled from like Central America and places that voted for the Donald. I think that's it fuels the power and the ability of people in order to be able to organize in other places.
Well, I guess it's the opposite of slacktivism, right? It's not signing a petition on the internet. You actually have to make some kind of significant time sacrifice to go out there and engage. So it does seem more likely that those people would be the sort of people who would do more, have more involvement in politics further down the line. I mean, but aside from the, like, I still haven't quite got what this march was about, other than just registering a general discontentment with the US election. Is that all it's about, basically?
It was, I think that was essentially what it was about. I think it was about frustration and the need of people to feel communal again and together. Like, it was incredibly unviolent. It was incredibly civilized. It actually felt like a nice little stroll through London through most of it. And it was really, really chilled out and like just a nice atmosphere.
Why was it hooked around the idea of women then, if it was about the US election?
Because women are the biggest group that Donald Trump has offended, essentially.
That seems a weird sort of criteria, really.
I don't think so, because I think for somebody to be able to act appallingly and say appalling things about people based on their gender, who are the majority of the world, is bloody ridiculous for him to have been able to be elected. That is mad. And people were showing their frustration with the madness that was occurring.
I guess, but you know, there's
there are also other people that he's offended, like Mexico, like all of it. like people from Muslim backgrounds and loads of people have been offended by him, veterans have been offended by him, and so it's I think that just ended up being the one that took off and is the most universal one that was able to galvanize people internationally as well.
I mean, what was the gender composition of the march then?
I reckon it was about 60-40, maybe 65-35.
Okay. Women. Right, so there are at least a third of men there then.
I reckon so, yeah.
Okay.
But they were deliberately this is a march that everybody can come to. And there were loads of families and stuff.
The whole idea of family protest. And I know you mentioned that your parents weren't the sort of people that would take kids to marches, but
they're just not the type of people that would go to marches at all.
Right, okay, but I think it's really sinister that you get these activists who bring their 8-year-old children who blatantly have no idea what really is going on. I suppose you have to if you can't find a babysitter or whatever, but it does seem a little bit weird to give them a little banner and indoctrinate them into your own particular worldview.
I actually quite well. So, I saw nothing. I agree that occasionally it's used in quite a sinister way.
I wouldn't say occasionally. Of the marches I've been on, I'd say it's the norm to have children waving banners because children love doing that sort of thing.
Waving banners, but waving banners like there were loads of kids that would say "future feminist" and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's sinister. That's kind of weird.
No, Jimmy, feminism isn't sinister.
I think we have a difference of opinion on the benignness of feminism, but I think it's a bit weird to force your views down your child's throat to that extent.
Sure, but my dad wanted me to play golf.
Hmm. Okay. What's wrong with golf?
Everything is wrong with golf.
Don't think encouraging your child to play a sport is anywhere near equivalent to.
But you're a product of your parents. My parents decided to take me to museums. I don't think that there's anything particularly.
Yeah, but taking someone to a museum is quite different from pushing them to joining the local Young Conservative Association. So.
I don't think that 8-year-olds are joining the Young Conservative Association.
I'm using it as an analogy, Jazza.
What I did find quite sinister was the number of groups that kind of hijacked the event a little bit and had stalls up. And obviously,
I'm guessing that the Socialist Workers Party.
Yeah, they were there. A load of protests against austerity, a load of people with banners against austerity and things, which are a little bit outdated because technically we're no longer practicing austerity.
There are a group of anti-austerity protesters who would of various different stripes and affiliations who would turn up to every single march that was going, basically. Over the past couple of years.
The argument that women are disproportionately affected by the austerity measures that were put in place by the coalition and then Cameron's conservative government. I get that, but that wasn't what this march was about. I think it was deliberately vague, and that was fine.
Surely the idea behind it being vague was that any particular point of view could be crowbarred in. Inclusivity and that and what have you.
I don't know. You're playing devil's advocate a little bit, I feel. But I don't. It just made me feel uncomfortable. The Conservative Women's Association weren't there. Why weren't they there?
Conservatives generally don't march because they're usually the ones more or less in charge.
Do you not remember the lead bangers, the Andrea Leadsom marches? The group of 30 people who were going, who do we want? Angela, when do we want her now? Or Andrea, or whatever the bloody hell her name
is. She doesn't really have a chantable name. Didn't really work.
Speaking of female conservative politicians, is there anything else that you want to ask me about the march?
I think we've, if anything, talked too long. So you do your segue into Theresa May's Brexit speech.
Yeah, so from one Conservative lady MP to another. Theresa May said stuff about Brexit. Did you listen to it?
No, I read the speech, but I didn't listen to it.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, sorry, I read excerpts from the speech. I didn't read the entire speech. Who has the time? You know, some people have jobs.
I listened to it on times 2 speed.
Efficient.
And yeah, brilliant. It's much more bearable when it's half the time. We're leaving everything and we're going to become a tax haven, and I feel really horrible about it.
The tax haven thing's only a threat, isn't it, if we don't get what we want.
So she wants us, it seems like we still don't really know the terms of which we're going to be leaving the European Union, other than we're going to be leaving absolutely everything out. Like, it's slightly more clear, but we're still like, are we going to be able to have sector specific deals for stuff like car manufacturing and finance that are going to make it easier for example, car parts to move across countries, which is how a lot of manufacturers are still able to produce their autos in the UK, but have different parts manufactured in other parts of the European Union. We don't really know how that's going to work, and it actually goes against World Trade Organization rules, and it seems a bit weird because other countries would have to contest it, and why would anybody want to contest? Like,
I sort of feel that there's no level of detail that would satisfy people of your turn of mind in this instance, though, because prior to the speech being...
What do you mean by my turn of mind, Jimmy?
I mean Ramona's, basically, phrased more politely, but...
shall we not name call?
I tried not to, and then you made me.
You went people like you, which is basically the same thing.
I said people of your turn of mind. It was a lot more delicately phrased. I mean people who are very upset about the result, as opposed to people who voted Remain and have got on with their lives, which I think is the vast majority of Remain voters. But, you know, before she gave the speech, you know, people were complaining that there's no plan, there's no outline of what's going on. And now she has outlined her plans. You're like, well, we don't know any of the details. And it does seem to me that whatever it is she says, you will just retreat to the next set of barricades and then complain from there.
Jimmy, I the thing is, I really care about what is going to happen after. Like, I'm super invested with what is going to end up happening to this country. I lost the referendum. We lost the referendum. And so the consequences, I can't just sit back and let whatever happen. Like, I want to know what we're going to have to deal with. And I think that asking for there to be, to know whether we're going to turn into a tax haven, wanting to know whether we're going to have to break WTO laws in order to get preferential treatment for our biggest sectors, I don't think that those are unreasonable things to ask at all. Like, those are important things that we need to know, and we will eventually know once we enter negotiations. And it is obviously important that we know that we're going to pull out of the whole thing. And I said last week that actually, now that I've had time to think about it, I think that severing completely is better than having
one foot in, one foot out.
I think that is the better. That is the better option.
So surely on balance you must have approved of the speech.
Yes, but I still approved of the speech. As I said last week as well, I still think that this is a bloody horrible thing that's happening.
Right, okay, laying that aside, within the context of, you know, what the announcement that she could have made, she could have said, well, we're going to try and stay in the single market. She has outlined a plan that is roughly within your view of what should happen in a Brexit scenario.
Yes, but I still think it's terrible.
Right, okay.
I just want to make that really, really clear.
So would you prefer a soft Brexit, or you just think that, politically speaking, hard Brexit is necessary? I'm not understanding your position here.
I think that in the long term, a hard Brexit is probably better for reasons of... I think because otherwise we end up not being able to have a say of the regulations that govern the country.
Right.
So that from that line, like I understand that argument, but then we've decided that the UK is going to be sovereign, and the UK is going to decide what kind of like what is going to happen in terms of trade and in terms of the policies towards immigration and all of those kinds of things. What I now care about, and I may be retreating to the next barracks, what I now care about is the type of country that is going to come out of that severing from the European Union. And I don't think that that is an unreasonable thing to be concerned about and arguing about.
But ultimately, that
I'm
will be a matter for whichever governments are, come to power within the next couple of decades. It won't be purely down to Theresa May.
Yeah, but she's going to be setting that ball rolling. And who knows, she might be in power for a couple of decades. We've got no laws to stop that.
She won't be in power for a couple of decades, I shouldn't imagine. But she could be in power for the next 10 years. That's very plausible. But
What did you think of her speech? I want to know what you want the UK to look like now that we're going to have the Brexit that we both agree is probably the best one.
Well, I said that if I would have preferred us to remain within the EU rather than have a soft Brexit, because I think
Yeah.
a soft Brexit has many of the problems that I associate with the EU, but fewer of the advantages.
Yeah.
So you've already kind of referenced one, the ability to actually contribute to rulemaking. If you look at the Norway situation, because it's part of the European Free Trade Area. It has to abide by quite a lot of rules within the EU, but has less say in, well, no say in making them. And it also has to pay a fair amount of money to actually retain membership of the single market as well, as part of the European Economic Area. Which did, that doesn't that certainly doesn't seem within the spirit of the referendum result, I wouldn't say. I know there's a lot of ambiguities around what it was that people actually voted for, but I can't imagine that it seems implausible to me that a Leave voter would actually want us to have to adhere to a lot of the rules of the single market and also sit underneath the European Court of Justice, which is the EU Supreme Court, without having, an involvement in the decision-making processes behind those two things.
Cool. So, what do you want a Brexit Britain to look like? Would you be okay with the UK becoming a tax haven?
It's almost irrelevant there whether or not the UK becomes a tax haven because so many of our crown dependencies are already tax havens. So I mean, we'd be if I don't even really understand this line of thinking. It's not something that I've looked into in a great amount of detail, but it does seem to me kind of strange that we would be competing with many of our crown dependencies, like such as the Cayman Islands, is the one that would most spring to mind in the
The Cayman
Caribbean.
Island, Jerseys, no, not Barbados,
Bermuda, I think you're thinking
Virgin
of.
Islands.
Yeah, there's. Well, I don't know. This was kind of the vision of the Dan Hannans of this world, the Tory MEP, who wanted us to leave the EU and then deregulate all of our markets. And I'm not in favour of that because I think that markets that function well for consumers are not always markets that have no regulation. In fact, very frequently, I think, or most of the time, they need some regulation, although you can argue, depending on the sector as to how much is necessary. But I certainly wouldn't want to see complete deregulation. I think that the idea that you could be pro or anti-regulation seems foolish to me. It depends how the regulation is working. In a particular instance, you have to take each one separately. So I'm not really in favour of all of that sort of thing.
So what do you want it to look like, though? I know you're not a politician and you're not creating policy, but I am going to push you on this because I give my opinion too much.
The thing is, the reason that I voted Leave wasn't so much because I was miserable about the general direction of Britain as a country. It was more a constitutional point, and it was also a point about it tallied with my view of the EU as an organisation. I think the EU is pretty dysfunctional in terms of how it works because of the way that it's evolved and the way it was constructed. It's the euro, for instance, I think is emblematic of how the EU goes about making policy. It does it very heavily in line with this ideology, broadly speaking, that more integration is better, which she, I don't really agree with as a general point of view, but I also don't really subscribe to the idea that I don't particularly want necessarily to be part of a European polity, I suppose. But that, this is the point about identity. You happen to feel
Jimmy, I need to stop you because you're having the same conversations that we were having. You're saying the same things that we were saying before the referendum.
Right.
I want to know what you want the country to look like.
Well, as I said, I wasn't that unhappy with the way Britain was governed generally. I just thought that the point that Britain should be governed effectively by British political institutions that people had some degree of democratic involvement with was important. I don't think the EU is democratic, and I don't think it is capable of reforming itself in the near future to become democratic.
So are you saying that you don't particularly mind as long as the British government and the British courts are deciding what direction it goes in?
Yeah, but I don't think that's a flimsy point. I think that's...
No, not at all.
You know.
But the you're still... Even though they are democratically elected, open brackets, with a really flawed electoral system, close brackets.
It's still less flawed than the European one.
They are going to be making decisions that you're still allowed to disagree with.
Yes, that's true.
Democracy. And one of the reasons that we do this podcast, I hope you agree, Jimmy, is to encourage people to think about politics not just when there's elections. People need to know what's happening with politics as much as possible so that they can make informed decisions.
Mm.
And you're allowed to be like, yeah, I lost an election, or I lost a referendum, but I still care about the decisions that are going to be made. I'm not just going to roll over and let anything happen, right?
Right, I'm just making... You're sort of referencing that first point I made, which was that whatever it is that Theresa May does, she will be criticised by people who are fundamentally unhappy with the referendum result and are using whatever argument they can cobble together to attack her with.
Sure, but do you appreciate that I'm not doing that?
I feel you're doing it a bit, but I understand the argument that you are interested in the process behind this. But I think it's obvious that these negotiations are going to be very complicated, and you know, you are just not going to know some of the details until they've been finalised, and that's just the nature of the game.
Yeah, but if there is anything that I can do to make sure that we're going to get as good a Brexit as possible, then I want to be able to decide that.
Right. The nature of British politics...
Not decide it, but know, so that I know whether or not, to be frank, I become Swedish.
Are you thinking of applying for Swedish citizenship?
They're really, really good at Eurovision. I'm so into that.
Well, look, the way that British Parliament is set out at the moment, and the state of Labour and everything else, means that the Tories are in power now for the foreseeable future. They will be the party that pushes through Brexit, and there's very little that, you know, anyone outside of that little cabal of people can do to influence how this is going to turn out. This is, you know, kind of a stoical point. You just kind of have to wait and see at this point.
Yeah, Jimmy, you're kind of depressing me a bit with your, like, laying over and allowing Theresa May to rub your belly.
I'm not laying over. It's just like, you have to, like, one thing that you have to accept if you're interested in politics is that your vote pretty much doesn't count. It doesn't really matter. If you don't vote, it will not affect
Don't listen to him, listener. Don't listen to him.
No, it's just, it's a mathematical point. And it doesn't mean you shouldn't be interested in politics and that you shouldn't follow it, but you have to accept that the influence of any one individual that is not in a position of authority is negligible, by and large.
But then I'm still a little frustrated with the fact that you are like, I think that these people should be making the decisions, but then I want to know what it is that you... In an ideal world, what decisions you would want those people that you've elected, that we've elected as a country, what decisions would you ideally want them to be making?
To be honest with you, I don't have a view on quite a lot of issues because I respect the fact that they're pretty complicated, and if I haven't actually looked into them, then it's just a knee-jerk reaction based on whatever my, you know, political prejudices are. It doesn't really mean very much.
Oh, you're making me really sad.
And why does that make you sad? That's just a statement of the obvious. Like, I mean, if you want to run me down every single policy area, I can give you my view roughly on you know, where I think there are problems and what I might potentially reform. But the truth is that I don't have an opinion on most political issues, despite running a podcast.
Right. So this podcast is now going to turn into Jazza Runs Policy Ideas Past Jimmy. We're going to get, by 2020, we're going to stand you in a seat and you're going to have a comprehensive policy plan for all of the major pillars of government. How does that sound?
It sounds awful. I don't see what you're driving at. Like, I mean, in broad terms, me and you probably have quite similar views roughly on, say, how the economy should be run, and even on...
You'd be surprised, listener. You'd be surprised.
Even on areas of social policy, despite the fact, you know, I'm a lot more critical of the social justice movement than Jazza is. Yeah. We're not actually...
Jimmy thinks feminism is a cancer.
I have not said that. I did say it was sinister earlier, though. But even that said, in social policy terms, we're actually pretty similar as it goes.
Yeah.
So, there's my answer for you, I suppose. It's not.
I'm going to maintain that that's not an answer.
How is that not an answer?
It's fine. No, it's fine.
This is fucking outrageous. What do you want me to answer? If you give me a direct question, I will respond.
I've literally asked you about four times. What do you want the UK to look like trade-wise when it comes to dealing with the European Union? Do you want us to be breaking WTO laws? Do you think that it would be better for us to ignore the European Union and go back to standardised WTO laws that would damage our our financial services and our auto industries, for example, and we should actually pivot and focus on faster developing economies, which is an argument that I completely understand, but we have to accept that that is going to economically affect our biggest sectors very, very strongly, because they are the most tied in with the European Union. Do you think that a tax haven and deregulation is possibly the best option for us?
Well, I think I've answered the deregulation point.
You don't like that very much.
No, I think blanket deregulation is just as stupid as blanket regulation. It has to be dealt with on a case-by-case basis. I don't really understand all the ins and outs of the World Trade Organization rules and that sort of thing. And I think it will only emerge over the coming years where the biggest opportunities for growth are. And you know, trying to forecast way ahead into where our main trading partners are going to be in 30 years' time is completely pointless, as far as I can tell. It's obvious that there will be more growth in developing economies because there's more headroom, and you know, that's just a structural thing. But you know, I find it very hard. This is an exact example of why you shouldn't just speculate randomly on policy, because this is an immensely complicated policy area, and the only people who should have opinions on this are economists who specialize in it, to be honest with you.
Right, so still haven't answered the question.
That is an answering of the question. I told you I basically don't know.
Oh, that's all I wanted.
That's literally what I was saying.
All I wanted was those three words.
Oh, I'll say I don't know more often, actually. It's if I'm not answering the question, just assume I don't know. That's cool. Just as a rule going forward, you know.
Would you like to talk about Trident for a little bit?
God, I need a drink after all that. Let's talk about Trident. Okay.
Just to recap on the story, it transpires that there was a test of the missiles that carry the nuclear warheads from one of our submarines that carry our nuclear arsenal in the UK. I believe there are three... There were three submarines.
Yeah.
Yes. None of them are yellow, which is very depressing. And
it'd probably stand out a bit in the water. You need them a bit more camouflaged.
Yeah, I know, but it would have been like a nice cultural, Beatles reference. Would have been lovely.
would have been great options, for everyone.
Options for the renewed Arsenal. But the missile very soon before the British Parliament decided to renew our nuclear arsenal, this missile test malfunctioned and went completely in the wrong direction. Do you believe, Jimmy, that this would have altered the Prime Minister, Theresa May, has refused to confirm or deny whether or not she knew that this was the case before the vote, and they chose to hide it. And this story came out in the Sunday Times. Do you think that this would have had any kind of effect on the vote? Because the Conservative Party were very much for it. The majority of Labour MPs were for it, but it was a split decision there. Although famously Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of the opposition of the Labour Party, voted against the motion because of his own moral stuff.
He's a long-time supporter of the campaign for nuclear disarmament, isn't he?
Yeah.
Yes. And he also generally takes a dim view of any kind of military posturing by Britain, so it's no particular surprise that he's not down with the nukes.
Yeah, and I remember it was when Hilary Benn was still the Shadow Foreign Secretary, and he did a very rousing speech in favour of renewing the UK's nuclear arsenal. Do you think that? And he was applauded by a lot of people for doing so, because it seemed like a very moral and balanced thing that he was saying. Do you think that this, a malfunctioning missile should have swayed people's opinions and maybe changed public opinion as to whether or not we should have renewed it? Wow.
I don't know.
Oh, yeah, okay. That's it. Well, anyways, thanks for listening, everybody.
Should I give a more detailed answer as to what exactly I don't know?
Yeah, you can. Your point of me drilling you to say I don't know has been well made. I apologize.
Yes, yeah. Well, I guess in broad terms, that there's a general question to be had as to whether Britain is, you know, suitably powerful enough to actually justify spending money on having a nuclear weapon in and of itself. The actual details of what sort of nuclear weapon it should be, you know, how much money we should spend on it and all of that stuff, seems to me to be more one for military procurement specialists. I don't really see how one can have a view on that. Comes down to some topics are just too complicated for anyone to reasonably have an opinion if they're not informed on it. That being said, the significance of this particular test, which went badly wrong, is one for people who are experts in the field. I mean, I'm the reason they have tests of military equipment is because stuff goes wrong quite regularly, one would assume.
I'm not sure regularly, but like you have tests to see how something can go on and how stuff can go.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's a means of feedback. So I haven't actually read anyone say what the particular significance of this test was, but in general, I do support the idea that Britain should continue to maintain some sort of nuclear capacity. But I'm not particularly, I don't have a view what that capacity should entail in and of itself.
So the reason that I think that this is quite interesting is because I think this would have been a scenario and something that would have happened that could have quite easily been latched on to by members of the media if they wanted to.
Yeah, for sure.
And something like this could have quite easily been. So I'm also on balance pro the UK having a nuclear deterrent. Pro nukes, yeah. Oh God, somebody's going to clip that one day and that'll come back and bite me on the ass.
You've already provided them with a wealth of clippable material from this podcast. If you ever decide to stand as an MP, it'll be over before you start.
That's not going to happen, Jimmy. Like on balance, I think that a nuclear deterrent is something that we should have. And obviously, in this case, there was a test and the test went wrong, and that's why tests happen. But this could have quite easily panicked people, especially for people who live on like on and around the place where the a lot of our nuclear weapons end up being stored when the submarines are being
So that's Fastlane near Glasgow, isn't it?
Near Glasgow, yeah. And just in general, this could have quite easily exploded into quite a big story not even intentional puns. but where I think that this is particularly could have been particularly significant is in Scotland, where the Scottish National Party, who are the majority in the Scottish Parliament and also have almost all of the Scottish MPs in Westminster, they are the biggest party-wide anti-nuclear deterrent party in the UK, and they could have very easily spun this into a England and Westminster is keeping unsafe nuclear weapons near one of the biggest population centres in the United Kingdom.
I guess they could have tried that, but I think you're overestimating generally the significance of any one particular news story on how people think about politics. I mean, if you're generally in favour of nukes or of Britain having nuclear weapons, it's very easy just to dismiss this as a test that happened to go wrong. And if you're against Britain having nuclear weapons, it's very easy to say, oh, look, this is proof of how dangerous that nuclear weapons are. People are very, very good at rationalising new information to fit their original point of view.
So I think that's why I think it would have very much depended on how the media dealt with it.
Because I don't think it would have made a huge difference one way or the other, to be honest with you.
I don't know. I feel like this could have, because there's already quite a lot of resentment within Scotland with the fact that actually quite a densely populated part of the world, part of the UK, has ended up having nuclear weapons stored quite close to it. And there is the idea of why was Scotland chosen and not a remote part of Wales or England? And there is definitely resentment up north of the border when it comes to that. And I think that this could have probably tipped over and attracted quite a few more people towards the idea of perhaps even a Scottish, a second Scottish referendum. Because actually,
you are spinning this out of all proportion.
You know, I don't know, man. I think that all they need is, because there is going to be another Scottish referendum within the next decade, I believe.
You're laying that down now. How sure are you of that? What percentage chance do you think there is of another Scottish referendum in the next decade on independence?
Before 2027.
Yeah, put a percentage to it.
So I'm going to go 538 on your asses, and I'm going to say there is a 67% chance.
Okay, well, I'll hold you to that in some way. I'm not sure how, but at least we've quantified your certainty, though. So that's that's one step in the right direction.
I'm glad, and I was definitely scientific about it as well.
Yeah, it definitely sounded that way. I don't think, I mean, obviously, if Theresa May blatantly knew about it, otherwise...
otherwise she wouldn't be so coy. I never understand why they do this. Just say that you knew.
Just say, yeah, I knew. I hit up. I'm the Prime Minister. Deal with it. And then just walk off.
She mics drop on the Andrew Marr show.
I suppose... A lot of people don't actually watch these political shows, and it's more of a story if a politician actually admits to something bad, and then it can be clipped and it can go on the 10 o'clock news. So maybe that's it's like damage control or something. But yeah, presumably if the British government suppressed this story,
a little bubble.
Sorry, presumably if the British government suppressed the story, they were of the view that it was potentially dangerous for them or would adversely affect their arguments. So there is that.
I mean, yeah, of. Right, so still got nukes, though, so we're fine. Is there anything else you'd like to say about nuclear weapons?
There's nothing about nuclear weapons, but before we sign off, I think we should give 2 minutes to note that Paul Nuttall will be standing as MP in the Stoke by-election, so a potential MP in the Stoke by-election to replace Tristram Hunt, the Labour scion, former scion, I suppose.
Do you reckon he's got a chance?
I think the consensus view is that Labour will retain it, but I haven't.
So we said this last week. So Labour have 24,000 or something or so.
No, Labour have 12,000 votes when Tristram Hunt won the seat in 2015. UKIP and the Tories have 7,000 votes each. So obviously, if you aggregate the UKIP and Tory vote, you have a higher number of votes than the Labour vote. But it is a question of whether or not that split is maintained. It's probably more likely that the Tories would win, I'd have thought, given their general good polling. But I haven't really looked into the data, so I'm kind of spitballing here.
Yeah, there aren't huge amounts of polls on by-elections because it costs quite a lot of money to run them.
Yes.
But if... Do you think it would be significant if Paul Nuttall were to get in? And do you think it would be more of a gain for UKIP or more of a loss for Labour if they were to lose a seat?
I'd say more of a loss for Labour. I think that given the general shift in Theresa May's tone since taking over from David Cameron as the Prime Minister, there's less space for UKIP to be that reactionary party, I guess. Because Theresa May is generally... She's said a lot of stuff about equality and working class communities and attacked citizens of nowhere, which is people like Jazza, and just generally abused the metropolitan liberal elites like Jazza.
I'm enjoying this immensely.
There's a theme developing here. There's less space now for an anti-Jazza party in politics now that the Tories have moved rightward, I suppose.
And I think that this is actually the first proper test of that, of whether or not the Tories have encroached on UKIP, because all of the by-elections so far have either been, like, ridiculously safe seats, or they have been more liberal-leaning ones that don't have huge UKIP presence. So this is going to be, I think, actually really, really... I'm quite excited, because I haven't got a horse in the race, because the Lib Dems don't stand a chance.
You're surely not indifferent, though, as to whether Labour win a seat or UKIP win a seat. I assume you would prefer one over the other.
I think it would be quite nice for UKIP to have a leader actually in Parliament, wouldn't it?
Yeah, make a bit of a change.
Yeah, a bit of a change. Like 5 million people voted for UKIP, and more than anything, I believe in a proportionate representation of people's views, and a second UKIP MP would move us more closer to that utopian fantasy that I have. So actually, maybe I want UKIP to win. Grand scheme of things, who knows? All of my views are out of the window now. I think that hard Brexit is a good thing.
I suppose the other side of that would be if Paul Nuttall actually managed to do what Nigel Farage never did and win a seat in Parliament, it would probably put Nigel Farage's career more firmly to bed, at least in terms of his involvement in British politics.
Yeah, but now he's got a radio show on LBC, so he doesn't care.
He's set up for life now.
Set up
with
for Kate, life.
Katie Hopkins and James O'Brien.
Yeah. I quite like Katie Hopkins and James O'Brien.
You like Katie Hopkins?
Yeah, she was really nice when I met her.
You did say this, actually, yeah.
Surprisingly. Yeah, she was surprisingly, like, shy after she had laid into a couple of feminists in the crowd that we were.
She probably knew she was talking to a member of the Metropolitan Elite, so that's why she was so nervous.
Clearly, I wield such power. Thank you so much for listening. We have been Right Dishonourable, please. My brain's not working. Leave us a review.
Please like our shit on assorted social medias.
Follow us follow us on the socials. I'm at Jazza John if you want to scream into the void with me, and Jimmy is at JDE Nichols.
Indeed.
And we are Right Dis on Twitter.
On the Twitters.
Well, I think that was a great outro. What do you think?
I thought it was about as smooth as the intro, so yes.
Yeah, excellent.
Yes.
All right, toodaloo, everyone.
All right, bye-bye.